the streets are screaming now. They brought death to our hometown, boys. Death to our hometown, boys. Death to our hometown, boys. Death to our hometown.
Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, lots happening this past week. IMF, World Bank, meeting all the big boys meeting in Washington, growing increasingly concerned about the global economy and global trade stagnation, and now looking at another critical factor here, and that's a rising political populist opposition in the advanced economies to the status quo. We saw that in Brexit, of course. We see it emerging in Europe with parties of the far left and right emerging and destabilizing the status quo over there. We see it in the U.S. with the Trump phenomenon, and other independent parties there are struggling to get some coverage, but they're out there, and I'm talking about libertarians and the Greens. They still may be spoilers here in the election, and growing discontent under the covers there in China. So in India, large strikes going on everywhere. So the people after 8 years are losing patience here. And where they can, where there's parliamentary systems, they are turning to alternative parties. Where you have more difficult structure, political structures like the U.S., it takes its form in influencing candidates, non-traditional candidates, like Trump and others in the system. And then, of course, you get to China and places like that. It's all under the covers. Behind the scenes and doesn't get reported very well. But anyway, a lot of discontent, and the IMF and others have been meeting and here this past week, and we'll see what the leaks are, maybe next week. But they're warning about global economy and trade. The global trade is almost stagnant here this past year, and the trend has been clearly slowing down, the trade meaning exports, imports. The IMF, of course, comes out with a forecast where on one hand it says global trade is stagnating and the global economy is weak and fragile, and at the same time it says, oh, well, growth next year globally will be 3%, pretty much what its summer forecast was, which is nonsense. But the IMF and World Bank and OECD and these players have always done that. They've always been over-optimistic in their forecast because, their forecast has influences real conditions. So they always overestimate the forecast, and then they have to downgrade the forecast afterwards, which is what they've been doing for 5 years now. But if you look at some alternative estimations here of the global economy, the Brookings Institute recently put out an indication or a forecast, and this was just last week, and it showed the advanced economies, in other words, Europe, North America, U.S., Canada, Japan, Australia, and a few others, advanced economies are growing barely at 1% here the last 2 years. Not good. And actually, as a group, having experienced two brief periods of negative growth as a group, both in late 2015 and early 2016. And of course, we know the U.S. economy barely growing 1% first half of the year. We'll probably see a little bit of a pickup here in the third quarter U.S. GDP, but certainly less than the 2% figure. So the U.S. is slowing down more slowly than the rest. But as a group, the advanced economy is growing barely 1% for the last 18 months. Emerging market economies, as a group, once again, still in negative territory as a group. Of course, there are some exceptions to that, but other areas like Brazil, Russia, Latin America, all in recessions. And of course, China talks officially about GDP at 6.7%, but everyone who knows better estimates that the growth over there in China is slowed to about 4% and continuing to slow. China, of course, keeps battling with its rotating financial bubbles, as we've explained in the past and as I describe in great detail in my book, Systemic Fragility in Global Economy, Chapter 6, China, about royal toil and bubbles going on. What are the bubbles over in China? Well, there's basically three of them. They keep bursting in the property markets as all the excess money capital flows into property and then flows out when certain policies are adopted by the Chinese government, flows into asset management products, WIMPs, you know, wealth asset management products, they call them, or into stocks. We had that big stock bubble there that burst, and the money went back into property markets and caused a bubble again in property markets. So the Chinese government keeps trying to put a damper on these bubbles, but it puts the damper of certain policies on one bubble, and then the bubble appears somewhere else. That's because there's such an excess of money credit floating around within China. It's got to go somewhere. It could go out of China, but China doesn't want that money capital currency to flow out of China, so it has controls on capital flight. The latest bubble, it's been seeping out into the Hong Kong stock market. So we're getting another China bubble in stocks, but it's not in the mainland markets. It's in markets across the the so-called border there with Hong Kong. So you still have rotating bubbles going on in China, and at the same time, China is trying to make that transition to consumption-based growth with the rising consumption income by their middle class, of course, just gets pumped into financial asset markets instead of into real investment that China had hoped it would. But that's the story everywhere around the globe. All this excess money capital and the disposable income by investors, talking about trillions and trillions of dollars, keeps getting funneled into financial asset investments instead of into real asset investment. And meanwhile, China is trying to deal with a big debt problem with its industrial companies that make industrial goods that they can't sell now because of the global market trade slowing down. So big losses there, and they keep bailing them out. That's a big bubble. You know, over $25 trillion in additional credit and debt has accumulated in China since 2010. $25 trillion just in China. It's a massive credit debt run-up over there. And the only thing keeping a lid on it is China's government-controlled banking system able to enforce some discipline and cover it up. If it were a private banking system, it would have blown long time ago. So we got the IMF warning about global economy slowing and trade, and of course what they're talking about and not reporting, I'm sure, is the problem with Deutsche Bank, the big German investment bank in Europe there, and its growing problems, Deutsche Bank. We'll watch that. It could be a significant factor. And, of course, the negative interest rates and other slow growth and so forth in Europe is causing a squeeze on banks like Deutsche Bank and Commerzbank and others. So the banking crisis that I've been talking about in Europe is not confined simply to Italian banks, where, of course, they have over $400 billion in non-performing bank loans, and their income, bank income, is slowing or declining in some cases, so you can't pay the debt, the principal and interest on the debt. It's the combination of excess debt accumulation and the inability to finance that debt, i.e. pay principal and interest, as sources of income slow or decline, that precipitates the crises, the financial crises. So it's a debt-income relationship. A lot of economists and people on the left talk about, too much debt, but they don't explain the process by which too much debt leads to a financial crisis. Well, that's what I do in my book, Systemic Fragility, looking at different places globally and predicting that before 2020, we will have another major financial instability event, a financial crisis. It's coming, no doubt. We've been building up all this debt since 2010. In fact, the IMF just recently indicated that there's $152 trillion in debt, global debt, $152 trillion. We've been running up global debt faster than we did before the 2008-9 crisis, even faster. It's okay to run up the debt as long as your income rises correspondingly, so you can finance the principal and interest on the debt. But where you get problems is when income flows are insufficient. And, of course, we always have business cycles, and when you have a business cycle, the income flows slow down and or decline, and then the inability to pay for principal and interest on the debt becomes an issue, see? And when it becomes an issue, you got a few choices. One, you can declare that debt payment default. In default, problem is when you go default, then the financial asset prices start to collapse, right? Investors believe that, we're not going to get payment on these assets, these securities, so let's sell them real quick, get what we can out of them, right? So it starts with the run-up of excess debt, credit and debt, but then it reaches another stage when there's insufficient income to service it, begins to decline. It reaches a third stage when there's defaults occur, and then financial asset prices collapse. And as I've talked about, when financial asset prices collapse, it drags down prices everywhere, including in the real economy. And when that happens, investment freezes up in real assets that create jobs and income, and layoffs occur. And now you've got a feed-on knock-on effect, a feedback effect on the real economy. The real economy and the financial economy work in tandem in terms of feeding off each other in a decline. That, in a nutshell, is my theory of systemic fragility, which affects the financial and the non-financial economy and how they interact with each other. The problem with mainstream economics is economists don't pay any attention to the financial side and financial cycles and so forth. They don't understand it. They're not trained in it, you see. They're all trained in looking at the real data from the national income product accounts, right? And it's all real data, and their models are all based on real data. You know, the DSG models, they call them, and that's what they use to forecast, and that's why they can't forecast very well anymore. They don't understand the relationships between the financial side and the real side of the economy, and they keep talking, through the old conceptual apparatus of economics, which is totally defunct now. That's what's happening in terms of the IMF and looking at the global economy, as IMF Director Christine Lagarde quoted a few days ago before the meeting. The global economy is weak and fragile, and they're increasingly concerned about it. But yet, they're forecasting no change. we'll see. They'll change. They'll downgrade their forecast again. Brookings is more accurate, I think, in its estimation. Okay, so that's the IMF this past week, and we'll hear more from them next week, I'm sure. What another important issue here worth chatting a bit more about is the European Central Bank. I will have a new book coming out in the spring called Central Bankers on the Ropes, summarizing the failure of monetary policy, you know, low and negative rates, QE, and everything over the last 5-6 years. Failure in terms of stimulating the real economy. It's not failed in terms of stimulating financial security prices for wealthy investors. It's been very successful in that regard. Right now it looks like there's a shift that's about to occur in policy. I'll be talking about that more here, but what this shift is, it's clear that monetary policy is no longer working even for stimulating financial asset prices. It certainly hasn't stimulated the real economy very much, as long as it was boosting stock, bonds, and other prices, financial securities, they kept it going. It meaning near zero rates, negative rates in Germany, in Europe, and Japan, QE, massive QE injections going, just flooding the market with money, driving down rates to near zero as a result, which led to speculators, banks, and professional speculators, and borrowing the money at no cost and investing it. Massive demand for financial asset security prices drove up the price, big capital gains, right? Just in bonds alone, in the U.S. alone, in the last 5 years, investors and banks and corporations have given back to their wealthy shareholders $5 trillion. Running in dividend payouts and stock buyback payouts are running at about $1 trillion a year just in the U.S., right? Massive redistribution of income from creating financial asset price inflation. That's where the big wealth gains are coming from. That's why the 1% has gotten 95% of all the income gains here since Obama came into office. One of his great legacies, you see. We'll be talking about Obama's legacies here and as we get closer to the end of the year. Massive increase in wealth and income gains from capital gains by the very 1%, 5%, especially the 0.1% of households in the U.S. So the Fed and central banks have been successful in doing that, you see. But they're not able to push it any further, you see. The stocks, S&P 500 and the Dow in the U.S. and so forth, and the DAX in Germany and the FTSE in the U.K. Stock markets, right, are sort of churning. They can't go any higher with this false money injection policy. Rates, bond rates, have collapsed to near zero or negative, and bond prices move in the opposite direction. So, if you had invested in the bond price, rates have collapsed, you've made a nice gain on bond price inflation. All of that is kind of come to a halt. They can't push it any longer. And in fact, it's not only not producing the results of financial assets, it's causing contradictory results for the financial markets and systems now. It's not only positive, it's becoming destabilizing these markets. How so? Destabilizing what? Well, you can see it very clearly in a number of areas. One, of course, is pension funds and insurance companies, right? They're really being squeezed. They can't make any money off of fixed interest, because interest rates are so low. They don't make their money out of speculating in bonds so much as they do in interest income flows. So insurance companies, that offer annuities are losing money. Pension funds are losing big money. They have to, pension funds have to return about 6-7% on their assets in order to cover their pension payments. But they're earning, 1-2%. Well, that can't go on forever without the pension funds being grossly underfunded. So it's a big problem in the pension funds that's going to erupt here after the elections, for sure. Insurance companies that sell annuities, the same thing. Retirees, we have 50 million retirees who depend on fixed income, and they've been earning nothing for the last 6 years. Well, how long can that go on? It certainly constitutes a drag on the U.S. economy. These super low rates are causing what's called the speculative reach for yield. In other words, taking on investors and pension funds and others, taking on more and more risky speculative investing just to get a higher yield, higher interest rate, right? You can get your 6-7% interest rate if you want to buy minus triple B rated junk bonds. Yeah, when the next downturn comes, they go bankrupt and you lose everything, right? These low Fed and central bank rates are resulting not only in crises for pension funds and insurance companies, but causing investors to speculate, reaching for yield more and more. And even bank profit margins, commercial bank profit margins are being squeezed here, especially in Japan and in Europe here. Negative rates means that, banks can't make much interest rate money on their loans, so they don't loan. And if they don't loan, then you have little to no growth. No bank lending means no real investment, and income generation is stagnant, and that's the case in Europe and in Japan. So what happens is in Europe and Japan, you have the central bank buying up these loans and these corporate bonds, private bonds, not just government bonds, in a desperate move, to try to create more demand and more lending. Well, it's not happening. All the corporate bond buying, government bond buying by the ECB in Europe and Bank of Japan has not resulted in any real bank lending into the real economy and therefore any real growth. That's why Europe is stagnant and Japan keeps flipping in and out of recessions. Real economy, you see. So bank profit margins, and at the same time, because the banks are weak, especially in Europe, they've never recovered from 2008-09. It's been covered up, and now we're seeing it, in Italy and Portugal and Germany and so forth. It's, the rocks are beginning to appear above the water level. They never really recovered, and now you have negative rates, and at the same time you're raising the capital requirements, meaning banks have to hold more money and not lend it, out of concern that they are financially fragile and unstable. Well, the combination of negative rates and higher capital requirements because they're weak crimps into bank profits even more and results in even less bank lending and less economic recovery. So all in all, it's pretty clear that monetary policy, central bank monetary policy, which has been driving the global economy since 2009 in terms of recovery, has run its course. It's run its course. It's producing more contradictory negative consequences than even boosting asset prices and enriching investors and causing the shift to the financial side of the global economy, where the profits are, see, and the shift is sucking money out of real investment that creates jobs and income and recovery. This whole monetary policy thing by the central banks was created as the main lever of recovery from the 2008-09 crash. The banks, were clearly in the red, deep holes, deep losses. So, okay, the whole theory was let's get the central banks to bail out the banks. And if they're bailed out, then they'll start lending, and the consequence, follow-on, will be bank lending, and the real economy will, real investment will follow. That was the false theory. What happened was the money went into financial asset markets, or it flowed out of the advanced economies through the central bank money injection. And flowed into emerging markets for a while, China and so forth, commodity-producing emerging markets, right? But that that didn't last all that long, 3-4 years, and that's collapsed as well. Although we still see money flowing to emerging markets as the U.S. dollar fluctuates, right? When the dollar rises, the money flows out of emerging markets back to the U.S. When the dollar stays low, keeps devalued, the money flows out of the U.S. to emerging markets. So emerging markets are just a yo-yo consequence, their economies, of what happens in the U.S. and advanced economies. So we're going to see a collapse, further collapse again, further volatility in emerging markets as soon as the Fed starts raising raising rates. This whole monetary policy thing, of course, has failed miserably. The real economy and all this trillions and trillions and tens of trillions of dollars of injection by central banks, estimates are about a fifth or a fourth at most of that money injection results in real asset investment. And again, a lot of that flows out to emerging markets. And the rest flows into speculative financial investing, or is just hoarded on bank and corporate balance sheets, you see. Non-financial corporations have also accumulated massive debt, be it at low rates, but still massive debt. That will have to be paid for and rolled over at some point before 2020, and that will cause problems as well. So a lot of negative consequences of this monetary policy that was designed to bail out the banks, and then they just continued it, you see. They just continued it because of the influence of banks and financial institutions and investors on governments now. They have a stranglehold on it, on these governments, including in the U.S., and they've been able to squeeze, and continue the policy that was designed just to bail them out initially and continue it. That's been the problem. They've continued these zero rates and QE for a long, long time, and now it's destabilizing the global economies, no longer even generating the 20-25%, and no longer even pushing stock and bond prices through the roof as it did, and resulting in these negative developments. And that's why they're going to change, you see. That's why we're going to see a big shift here in 2017, I predict, away from monetary policy. We're going to see the Fed raise rates. We'll talk about that more shortly. Raise rates in November, maybe even December. I mean, maybe December, certainly. Maybe even November, we'll see. They're just holding off now because of the election, not raising the rates. The Fed doesn't want to destabilize the economy and be blamed for it right before the election. It's being blamed for this longer-term problem it's created, a lot of growing political opposition to the Federal Reserve, being in the hip pocket of the bankers, which it's always been. The Federal Reserve was always created with that purpose in mind, In 1913, it was created to bail out the banks because the banks always need bailing out periodically. It's always going to happen in a capitalist system. And in the 19th century, they used to the big bankers would bail themselves out because there was no Federal Reserve. But by the 20th century, it became pretty clear in the 1907-08 financial crash that the private sector could not bail themselves out. So the government had to step in, the Treasury, because there was no Fed, and bailed out the banking system once again. And the realization was that, there had to be a new kind of institution that was not directly political in terms of what people perceived as political. Treasury bailouts or, the government. And the regime, the parties, right? Direct Treasury bailouts get a lot of opposition because Congress has to approve the bailouts. Well, when you got a Federal Reserve Central Bank, you don't need Congress to approve anything, and the politicians quietly wash their hands of the whole thing, and they let the central bank create money to bail out the private banking system. That's been the number one objective of central banks and the Federal Reserve since 1913. And initially, the Federal Reserve was really run by the banks themselves. Yeah, the private banks funded the Federal Reserve, and they sat on all the regional boards, the governors, and they decided how much money to give themselves for free, you see. That broke down in the 1930s. The Fed did, bailed out the banks and investors at the expense of deepening the depression in the 30s. That's a historical, empirical fact. The Fed was told to go sit in the corner, and under FDR, the Treasury took over. Well, they allowed the Fed to come back in the 50s and 60s, and never since then. Central banks have increased their role and influence, especially since the collapse of the Bretton Woods international monetary system in the 70s. It's been central banks running the show. And the central banks are still, pretty much the handmaiden of the private banking system. The private banks still pay the operating cost in many cases and sit on. It's not totally private bankers running the board of governors, the district board of governors, and the Fed, but they are heavily influenced there. Have a role, and in each of the 12 federal districts of the Federal Reserve, and now some folks are beginning to realize this, that they still have too much political influence within the Fed, and that somehow they should be banned from bankers should be banned based on conflict of interest of sitting in any of these Federal Reserve districts in the U.S. And there's some truth to that, right? The Fed needs to be democratized. You need to take it out of the hands of the big banks. And when we say banks, we mean, shadow banks, hedge funds, private equity, as well as the commercial banks like Chase and Wells and so forth, right? Okay. The European Central Bank this past week undertook a shift, which is ominous and important. The European Central Bank has been talking about, well, maybe we're going to taper off our QE. They were going gung-ho there since they introduced QE and expanding QE at the rate of about $88 billion a month. In other words, the European Central Bank's buying $88 billion every month, and will do so up until March 2017, of bond buying. In other words, they buy the bonds and they pump that money into the economy. And not just government bonds, they're buying up corporate bonds as well because they're running out of bonds to buy. And it's benefiting mostly, the larger economies like Germany and so forth, and not so much the periphery. It's like a two-tier system over there, which I talked about in great detail in my book just published this month, Looting Greece, Emerging New Financial Imperialism. By the way, all my books you can refer to my blog, jackrasmus.com, if you want to purchase them or go read some reviews. Right. Anyway, $88 billion, and the Fed is saying, okay, we may not extend it, right? Well, why is the ECB. Why is the ECB doing this? Why is it saying, you know, we're not going to continue pumping, we may not continue pumping $88 billion in? That's a reversal of its trend for quite some time here, the last several years, 2-3 years, right? Massive injections. Now they're saying they're going to slow down, maybe not do it, right? That possible shift is an indication the ECB looking at the Fed and expecting the Fed to raise rates. You see, if the Fed raises rates, the dollar goes up. If the dollar goes up, then the euro goes down, and the euro becomes cheaper, and Europe exports become cheaper relative to the dollar, and European manufacturing export companies do better at the expense of U.S. manufacturing export companies. If the dollar was not going to rise and interest rates were not going to rise in the U.S., then the ECB, like the Bank of Japan, would continue pushing even more money into the economy, their economies, through QE to drive down the value of their currency and stimulate their exports. But with the Fed now, pretty much that's a signal the Fed's going to raise rates here relatively soon. The ECB is saying, well, we don't have to continue with this. You know, we can back off a little bit, because continue with it generates these negative consequences of negative rates and so forth, right? Excuse me. So that's what's going on, and it's a flashing light that the Fed is going to raise rates. Also, you know, you read the editorial page in the business press, and all these big name economists who are connected with corporate America, right? Feldstein and others. Once they start writing about this, see, these are signals. They're telling people it's coming, and they're taking credit for it themselves. They know. They're connected. They know the decision has been made to raise rates, and so they're advocating that the rates be raised. That's part of conditioning the public to what's coming, you see. The fact that the ECB is in this, we're going to taper, they call this the taper talk, we're going to, you know, reduce, you know, our QE, is also an indicator of what's going on, right? Well, they have to reduce it because, as I said, they're running out of bonds. And they're generating new bond issues in Europe by U.S. companies and others because they know the bonds are going to be bought up, right? So, it's destabilizing, you know, the global economic system. Well, it's causing a feud in Germany as well, you see. The Germans are saying that the ECB, as a result of its very low negative rates, is causing problems in banks like Deutsche Bank, right? It's the ECB's fault. Its policy of negative rates is putting the squeeze on the banks over there, and Deutsche Bank, being an investment bank, and investment bank model essentially broken, has been broken for some time, is suffering, right? Well, the head of the ECB, Mario Draghi, comes out and says, no, it's not my low rates, it's overbanking. That's the problem. There's too many of you banks in Europe. You know, we don't have enough capital markets. In other words, like the U.S. and the U.K. capital markets, you know, being alternative to bank loans, bank lending. Europe has a very traditional banking system. The banks, commercial banks, play a more central role in the capital markets. You know, the shadow banks, hedge funds, equity funds, and so forth are undeveloped over there. So if you've got a problem with traditional banking, you've got a relatively greater problem in Europe than you do in the U.S. What Draghi is saying is overbanking, and you got to consolidate. You know, Germany, you got too many banks. Consolidate them. right? And Germany and the other bankers say, well, you know, you got these negative rates and you're saying we have to have all these money capital buffers we got to raise and rules and everything, so you're squeezing our margins, our profit margins, you know, and that's why we're in trouble, right? Well, they're in trouble because of, you know, Deutsche is in trouble because the decline in its income flows, you know, from financial trading and derivatives and so forth. This is what I said at the very beginning. You know, you can raise all the debt, and shadow banks, investment banks raise all this debt that they then loan out. You know, now when their income is beginning to slow down at the end of the cycle that we're at, they're having a hard time paying the principal and interest on that debt, right? Deutsche Bank is a microcosm for European banking system problems in general. The worst case, of course, is Italy, right? But Portugal, Austria, France, they all have the same problem. It's just that the water level has not fallen far enough that it shows the rocks in France and Austria and so forth. You know, it's beginning to fall in Germany. It's, you know, the rocks have been showing for some time in Italy and Greece and places like that, right? Well, the government will bail out Deutsche at some point, not right now, but at some point it will have to, and it will. Deutsche Bank will not be a Lehman Brothers event. But first, before the government bails them out, the government is going to insist that Deutsche Bank sell off its prime assets, raise cash money that way, and also issue new stock and raise money capital that way, right? And then, at some point, they will do it. They will help bail out, right? You know, what's an interesting side story here with the Deutsche Bank is why did the U.S. government at this point precipitate the Deutsche Bank problem by levying this $14 billion fine on them? Why now? It's an interesting question. Well, I think in part, at least, it has to do with the European Union attacking Apple and U.S. tech and pharma companies by saying, you guys have been getting away with not paying taxes to the European Union, now you're going to pay taxes. Now, this is the tax avoidance problem, inversions and so forth, that companies like Apple, you know, they you know, move their money around, and they say they got, you know, headquarters here and there in Ireland and so forth, and they pay 2% instead of 35% here in the U.S. They keep the money offshore. You know, there's $200 billion Apple has in cash, 90% of it's offshore, so they don't have to pay taxes, right? That's the whole gimmick that they're doing, these tech companies and pharma and banks and so forth. Big problem. Well, the EU said, Brussels, the EU said, well, you know, you guys are going to have to pay us some taxes. Even if you're not paying to the U.S., you got to pay us. And the U.S. Treasury, Jack Lew, jumps in and says, how dare you, Europe? You know, I mean, these are our companies, and we'll settle this tax issue. Of course, they won't. The Europeans have been waiting for the U.S. to make Apple pay its fair share. But the U.S. is clearly not going to do that. Democrats won't do that. The tech companies are industry sector that supports the Democrats, so they're not going to touch the tech companies. So Europe went ahead and did this, and, of course, pissed off the administration and Apple and others. And I think this is a pushback here. The U.S. is pushing back on Europe. Say, okay, you know, you stick a thumb in our Apple eye, we're going to stick a thumb in your Deutsche eye. And that's what's going on, inter-imperialist competition. And, you know, the U.S. banks are cheering this on because, you know, maybe in the whole process they're going to be able to penetrate Europe even more than they are, than they have, right? So there's a big, big capitalist competition with each other going on. Okay. Let's turn to federal interest rates, right? As I said before, rates are going to rise, maybe even November, right? Long-term rates are already drifting up in expectation of this short-term rate increase. So when we say Fed raising rates, we're talking about raising short-term rates. The Fed cannot directly control long-term interest rates, but they can influence it by, you know, raising and lowering short-term rates. It can't really influence long-term rates, but we're seeing long-term rates drift up now in expectation that the short-term rates are going to come. Why? Why now? Well, it's hard for the Fed to not raise rates because all the targets it's declared it has to reach have been reached. Critics of the Fed saying, well, you know, first of all, you said you're going to have a 2% inflation rate. Well, you got it. You know, the PCE, personal consumption expenditure, core rates are, you know, 2%. You said you had to get unemployment rate, then you said, after 2010, you had to get unemployment rate down to near full employment. Well, okay, you're at 5%. Just a couple tenths away from full employment. And then you said, it's not inflation, it's not unemployment, it's wage growth. You know, well, you've got 2% wage growth over the past year. Of course, a lot of that's all concentrated in the upper income levels, median and below. We got continued wage stagnation and decline. And the unemployment rate, yeah, it's at 5%, but that's the U3 unemployment rate, which is a poor indicator. The U6 unemployment rate, which takes into consideration the underemployed and discouraged workers and so forth, is, you know, between 9 and 10%. You know, so you still got 15 million people unemployed in the U.S. And a lot of the jobs that have been created are part-time temp contingent gig jobs. So they're not really real jobs in terms of you can support yourself and a family on it, right? And the PCE indicator, is really, inflation is up, but it's heavily influenced by rising rents and rising health care costs and premiums now and so forth. So it doesn't really reflect a real production increase and real demand increase. But nonetheless, you know, these indicators, inflation, unemployment, wages, have all been attained pretty much. So there's no official reason for the Fed not to raise. All the targets have been attained. So what are you doing, Fed? You know, it's supposed to raise, the critics are saying. Right? Well, it's not because of the election. But right after, watch. There's no real justification for continuing the very low rates and free money to investors because it's not pushing stock and bond prices any longer, you see. Stock, including the Standard & Poor's 500 here, stock earning ratios, price-earning ratios are 60% above the historic average. 60%. They just can't push it anymore, right? They got all the artificial increase out of it that they can. So the Fed knows that, you know. Fed knows that. It's getting all this political pressure. It can't hide anymore that its own targets have been reached. And it's not pumping up financial asset prices anymore. So, you know, the pressure is growing. At the same time, it's causing instability elsewhere. We talked about that. Pension funds, insurance, annuities, retirees' compensation, bank profit margins, right? We got a bubble in commercial real estate prices, you know, 10% a year for 5 years. That's a bubble, right? The Fed policy has been forcing the Bank of Japan and the European Central Bank into negative interest rate territory to try to offset and compensate the low dollar advantage of the U.S. that's been driven by the Fed, right? And, you know, another reason the Fed has tried to stay low with low rates here is because, as I said, if it raises rates, the money's going to flow out of emerging markets. Currencies are going to collapse in emerging markets. And U.S. multinational companies in the emerging markets are going to take a profit loss, a paper profit loss, right? As the currencies collapse there that they do business with, they're going to have a loss. So they've been lobbying the Fed to hold on, not yet. Well, you know, it's pretty obvious that the Fed is subsidizing with low negative low rates, subsidizing U.S. multinational corporations. So for all these reasons, causing instability and not pushing financial asset prices anymore, having reached all the targets, and growing political criticism aimed at the Fed. All these reasons mean that the Fed's going to raise, and the drifting up of long-term rates are an indication of this. The fact that ECB has backed off from further QE is an indication of this. And there's the business press flyers that have been coming out. All of it means that there's going to be a rate increase. Okay, what will be the effect of the rate increase? Right. Well, first of all, it will reduce U.S. real investment further, which is already barely growing. It's barely at 1% real asset investment, net private domestic investment, it's called, right? As rates rise, right? Well, that's going to slow U.S. exports, which are already slowing, manufacturing, which is already stagnant or slightly below, layoffs going on already in manufacturing. Autos have peaked. Autos, with rate increases, autos, all these discount deals that have been driving the auto market for 5 years, at a time when the auto sales are already peaking. Clearly, the rolling moving average, the 3-month moving average shows that autos are slightly declining now. And autos, by the way, have always fairly well forecast the turning of the cycle. That's why I believe, not just because of autos, because the rising rates and the slowing U.S. economy and other factors here, why we are probably going to experience a recession in 2017-18, right? Housing is the demand for housing is driven a lot by foreign money and by shadow banks, and it's been at the high end. We still have millions of people, in negative equity underwater in a lot of places in the country. And we haven't had a general housing boom here. It's been very selective at the high end. All these reasons, all these results are going to follow on the Fed rate increase that's coming, right? U.S. dollar is going to rise, and that means the emerging market currencies are going to decline sharply, and capital flight will resume out of those countries. But on the positive side, for Europe and Japan, they will be able to slow down QE because their currencies will decline in relationship to the dollar, and they won't have to use QE and negative rates to try to do that. Right? On the negative side, it's going to push China closer to devaluation. China has its currency pegged to the dollar here in a band, and it's their currency is trading at the very low end of that band, and a rise in the dollar is going to put more pressure on China to devalue beyond that band. We'll see how much. Depends on how fast rates rise and the dollar rises, right? But certainly, the stocks and bond markets in the U.S. are sort of churning. They're fragile in terms of they can't go any higher, and they're churning at the top. And it remains to be seen how much of even a small interest rate increase is going to really stimulate those stock and bond market contractions. Right? It may not take very much to cause a significant retreat in stock and bond prices in the U.S. We'll see how sensitive it is. It's been very sensitive to rate reductions, so stock and bond financial asset markets. So, it may not take very much. When investors make a lot of money, they begin to look for an excuse to grab their money and run. And if they see a shift having occurred in the direction of rates, even if the initial rate hike is not that much, if they see a shift, they just may take their money and run. It's a psychological thing, you see. The 0.25% rate increase last December by the Fed, pretty much caused the U.S. economy to stagnate. in the first quarter of last year, and it's, you know, not much of a recovery in the second, a below historic average recovery here probably in the third. The U.S. economy, GDP, has clearly been slowing from 3.5% in 14 to 2.5% to 2%, and now this year well below 2%. Okay. I predict that the stock and bond prices may collapse at least 20%, maybe even more, right? And high yield bonds prices will collapse definitely even more, right? Overvalued financial asset prices, you know, across the board could decline significantly. Okay, so why would the Fed do this? Well, you know, if it waits longer, it's going to be even worse contraction, and they know that. And they like to take their hits at the beginning of a new political regime, you see. Take your hits or start your wars at the beginning of your regime, and that'll give you time to deal with it before you have to run for re-election again, right? That's the thinking here. You know, which brings us to the coming election. I've been warning, as have others, that Donald Trump is not out of this race, right? The problem is you got 87% of the people have already made up their mind. And it only what matters is only in those 7 or 8 battleground swing states. And in those swing states, you know, Hillary has definitely lost the support of the white working class. And there's a growing question, you know, whether she can turn out the millennials in her support. I don't think so. And then, you know, the next question is, what about Hispanics and blacks? Latinos and blacks. Those are the three constituencies that put Obama in office here in 2012. They were all willing to give Obama one more chance. Of course, he blew it. And that hangs over Hillary, you see. The big gray eminence hanging over the Hillary's campaign is the Obama legacy and the failure in the last 4 years across the board, just about everything in the Obama regime. No one's talking much about that, but she's carrying that burden. You see, and it's going to really affect the turnout. It's all about the turnout of those three constituencies, white, uneducated, or high school educated working class, one, millennials, two, and Latinos, Hispanics, and minorities, three. Can she turn them out to vote? Well, you know, some data show that only of the likely registered Democratic voters, only 65% intend to vote. 65%. That's not good. That suggests that she's going to have a continued problem to turn them out to vote, and that's what the election is going to depend on. She clearly won the last debate, as I wrote. Go to my blog, jackrasmus.com, for my analysis of the first debate and its aftermath, what's happened since. She clearly won, but it didn't matter that much, you see. 87% made up their mind. And all that matters is the swing states and those constituencies, and it all comes down to turnout. And that's why she's running around trying to pump up her message about, you know, millennials and about free education and child care and, you know, these white working class issues, which she'll never get back. It's too late for them. And minorities. We'll see whether she can do that, and we'll see what happens in the second debate. Of course, Trump helps her by sticking his foot in his mouth at every chance he gets, right? So that's the layout on the election, and we'll be talking about that more next week. This is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions.